This is Fresh Air. Art was a chic investment in the 1980s, but now we're into the recession of the 90s and the art world is changing. Peter Sheldahl has been covering the New York art world since the mid-60s. Sheldahl is art critic for the Village Voice and a contributing editor for Art in America. His columns from 1978 to 1990 are collected in the new book Hydrogen Jukebox. This is how Sheldahl described the boom of the 80s. He wrote, "Money and contemporary art got married in the 80s. The couple was obnoxious and happy. Their style was nakedness, and their custom was to have sex in public." I asked him, who are the big losers in the art world during this recession?
Anyone who put money into art on the assumption that its value could only increase, they're going to have to think of new things to do with their holdings now. Maybe look at them. and a lot of dealers, including some good and honorable dealers, who were able to support this, their serious interests with, you know, the turning things over in the secondary market and so on. You know, if only the bad guys got hurt by recession, you know, we'd love them. It's a mess, but it's certainly not confined to the art world, of course. You know, at a time when people are, when people of all kinds are suffering everywhere, it's special tears need not be shed for the art world.
Did you feel that the coming of big money to art forced a lot of successful artists to lose touch with their own work in a way?
I think it definitely has a distorting and damaging effect. I would argue that perhaps the effect is less damaging than utter poverty.
Right.
And certainly, I was one of a lot of people who quite enjoyed the early 80s when new money arrived in quantity at the same time as a bunch of younger or underknown artists and fostered a scene of maybe a rising tide that lifted all boats, including the creative. And it simply spun out of control, as such things tend to.
When you're making the round of museums and galleries in New York, what are the ways in which you notice the recession? Can you tell at openings? Can you tell in just observing the mood inside the shows?
Well, certainly last year, I think people were just sort of in shock. It had become almost an expectation that shows would be sold out before they opened. And that's just simply ceased to be the case. There is a wonderful adaptability in the New York art world. I think as a milieu that aestheticizes everything. Notice this year, suddenly there is a kind of recession style. It's like the jewel box architecture, gallery architecture of the 80s is suddenly giving way to a kind of unfinished sort of poverty row look in certain of the new, more interesting galleries that in one way is making virtue of necessity and also recalling us to the last time that the art world, like the country as a whole, went through a serious recession, which was in the 70s.
In your own writing, you stay away from critical theory. You stay away from, you know, Marxist theory or deconstructionist theory,
mm-hmm.
or academic language at all.
Mm-hmm. I read this stuff. I mean, I feel like I need to understand it. I think privately I try to translate it into English and see if there's any meaning left over. Sometimes there is, and sometimes there isn't.
Do you find it a disturbing trend that so much of art criticism has been taken over by theory and by academic language?
I don't think it's been taken over. I mean, it's not as if there was a province there that they moved into. I think there are provinces being added. The idea that, I mean, that art criticism is studied in the universities is an absolutely dazzling idea to me. I've been doing it for 25 years, and 25 years ago it was, a much humbler and more obscure practice.
Now, you've been writing art criticism since the mid-1960s.
Yes.
But you don't have a formal art history background. You didn't study it in college.
No, I dropped out of college and I never took an art course. And I arrived at it. I grew up in Minnesota when I was about 20. I worked my way east as a newspaper reporter. And I've always been a poet and was got involved in the New York art world at a time when it was still traditional in the old sort of Parisian tradition for art critics to write, for poets to write art criticism. And in my case, it took.
If you're just joining us, my guest is art critic Peter Sheldahl, and he writes for The Village Voice, other publications as well. A collection of his writings has just been published. It's called The Hydrogen Jukebox. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Art critic Peter Sheldahl is my guest. You were a poet before you were an art critic, and
yes,
you still write poems.
Yes.
I'd like you to read a poem, and this is one from 1979, I think.
Yes.
And it's called I Missed Punk.
Yes, this is a poem from a brief poetry movement called Neo-Expressionism in Poetry, which I think was confined to myself and no one else took any notice of it. Anyway, I have it here.
Do you want to introduce it in any way before you start?
I think it explains itself. Certainly the date, 1979, is explanatory. And it's not, I guess it bears in some general way on a feeling about art. It also bears on getting older and other great themes. I missed punk. I missed punk because my record player was broken, because I was suddenly older, because I can stand only so much distraction, only so much excitement and elation, but mainly because my record player was broken and none of my friends cared much about new music. Back in the 60s, the thought that I'd missed something would depress me terribly. Now it's one of those things that happen. Who are we anyway? Any of us who care about new music or anything? We are ones who care about our own skins, certainly, about saving them and not being totally crazy and alone in pain. We will go through a lot of incidental pain as long as it keeps us in company, even ridiculous company, which most company is. We certainly don't want to be alone, and this makes us ridiculous. What I want to be is virtuous and noticed. What good is virtue if no one notices? You don't know it's virtuous unless someone says so. I missed punk, but it brushed past me in the cultural bazaar and seemed to drop a hint about virtue, being what I'd always thought, a readiness to lose, to let go, because only in loss is one not ridiculous, if anyone notices. Never resist an idea. Never say no to a contradiction. They have come to help you smash the ego, which always reconstitutes. And if it doesn't, well, your worries are over.
Do you often think about what you're missing now?
Oh, no, this is the last thing I think I worried about missing. I think I just resigned myself to a torrent of things missed. And as when you get to the point in life where you don't feel like going out after 10 p.m., vast areas of culture are forever closed to you.
There's a photo of you on the dust jacket of your new book, and you're dressed in black tie.
Mm-hmm.
Your hair is slicked back. You're gracefully holding a cigarette. In fact, you look very David Niven.
Oh, we were going for Waldo Nidecker. It's a character played by Clifton Webb in the movie Laura. The photographer James Hamilton, who is a great photographer and a great wit, suggested this. I think it's one of the two times in my life I've had on a black tie. And I thought we'd go for everybody's nightmare of what a New York art critic looks like.
Well, so what kind of reaction do you get when people don't know you and see the photograph? Like the first time I saw a photograph, I had no idea whether that was a commentary or the real you.
Well, who knows who we are? I don't know. It was we took then some straight photographs, and it was kind of on a dare that we decided to use this one. Some people have reported, you know, feeling immediate visceral rage upon seeing the photograph, and then been pleasantly surprised when they read the book. And others, I think, sort of got the joke immediately and thought it was pretty funny. A few people who care for me advised me not to use it because they thought people would be mean to me about it, but I haven't heard anything that way.
Do you ever feel like you made the wrong judgment, or, you know, that years later something that didn't mean anything to you or didn't move you started to look different, and you found something in it that you didn't initially see?
Oh, yes. I think that's, I think that's a circumstance of any mind that, anyone who has a mind changes it now and then. Certainly an artist, Philip Guston, whose abstract work when I was coming up when I was young was charismatic and soulful to me. And when he changed his style to this sort of raucous, goofy, cartoony, anguished stuff that he started making in 68 or 69, I hated it. It was probably 12 years until in which I had written with some passion against that work, that I guess the better opinion of people I respected wore me down, and I had a sort of epiphanic moment where I suddenly surrendered, I guess, my Guston of my youth, and accepted the Guston as he was, and saw what a marvelous thing he had done, and a brave thing.
Is it hard to change your opinion because you've already said what you felt in print, and it might prove embarrassing to change your mind?
Maybe this is an aspect of being self-educated. I mean, I've been embarrassed so many times that perhaps I even go out of my way now and then to risk embarrassment. It's like bee stings. I mean, the more times it's happened, the less it hurts, although you never like it. And I think that I enjoy people who take chances, and I've always wanted to be one of those people.
Do you think that the balance is shifting at all between museums and galleries in terms of who's doing the more adventurous, important work?
Certainly with the collapse of the market, the museums are becoming more significant again. Although I think, in a way, during the 80s, it was a bit of a mistake to assume that the galleries were doing it, the dealers. The dealers, I think, were quite happy to foster the illusion that they were in charge. But, in fact, it was collectors, sort of in mass new collectors who consulted with each other, and the artists themselves, the ones that had a talent for self-promotion and who were really fomenting reputations. Now, with the market down, the institutions, curators, I think, get to play a larger role and in mediating new art. Maybe even critics will have a little more of a say. There was a moment in the 60s, I remember, in the 80s, shortly before the crash, where I was speaking to a San Francisco collectors group about something, and I was sort of ruining the critics' loss of influence on this market that made reputations before we even heard of them. And a woman collector came up to me afterwards and said, "Let me see if I understand you, Mr. Sheldahl. Critics and collectors do the same thing, only collectors have more fun." And I had to admit that she had me very correctly. I was pleased last year to speak to the same group, remind them of that earlier remark, and to announce that from now on, critics were going to have the fun.
They're not going to have more money, though.
Oh, no. It's, no, but we're going to, we do it for attention. And when people aren't paying so much money that they're blinded by it, then they start paying attention, and that makes critics happier.
Peter Sheldahl's columns from 1978 to 1990 are collected in the new book Hydrogen Jukebox, published by the University of California Press. This is Fresh Air.